one of my other part-time jobs, and I'm not doing music, is I'm actually a podcaster for a video game company.
Oh, that's sick. Which one?
So it's actually for a video game analytics company. Okay. Usually people don't ask a follow-up question. So it's called Liquid and Grit.
Okay.
And the podcast is called Creators at Work. And we just interview people in the video game industry about like trends, etc. But it's all done over Zoom. So I know that like, hey, I'm gonna press record now. So absolutely no worries.
Yeah. The woman I just interviewed actually is a data analytics software engineer. She's now an instructor at Berkeley.
Oh, that through line. What a small world.
No one wants to hear it, but how important analytics are for literally everything.
Everything that anyone consumes or does, or like any decision that you don't have 100% control over, like that is what is actually happening, like behind the curtain.
Right.
So super, it's very much there, it's present.
Welcome to season 4 of Made for Music. I am your host, Duncan Byerjohn. For those that are unfamiliar, this podcast seeks to depict a comprehensive view of the music world from the artistry to the business so you can discover the resources available to you and most importantly, the stories behind the people making things happen. If you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. Also, just launched a newsletter you can sign up for at madeformusicpodcast.com, featuring podcast alumni, music reviews, and insights into the ever-evolving business. But without further ado, here is the next episode of Made for Music. Today's friend of the podcast is someone I've been a fan of for quite some time. If it's got strings or keys, she can play it. Growing up in a music-loving household with a singing mother, she delved into cello at just 8 years old, and she has not looked back. She delivers a wonderful blend of just raw singer-songwriter blues with the epic soundscapes of the classics. About a year ago, she pulled a Hail Mary, jumped on over to Nashville, without having visited, and over just 12 days brought her album Alligator to life, which is out now. Truly one of the strongest albums I've heard front to back in some time. Please welcome one of my favorite songwriters out of the Seattle scene and fellow lyric hoarder, Katie Cuffell.
She sounds great.
Truly wonderful. It is so wild that like a year ago, almost to the week, that we were going to have the live podcast.
I know.
Emailed for like art and whatnot, which I guess, again, thank you, like a year later.
I know. It's so wild. Just like, that's one of the trappings, I think, of the Seattle music scene, where everyone is so close and like knows everybody. But you can go like 2 years without meeting anybody face to face or like really having a conversation with them and still feel like, oh, I've seen them around, or I've heard their name, or I still feel like a close connection with them, even if, you know, that other level of communication hasn't happened.
Yeah, that's so real, because I found your music through starting this podcast, actually, because everyone, when I would be like, you know, who's folks you like in the scene, you were always name dropped.
Thanks to that SEO search function, Google backend stuff. I feel like a grizzled old music scene woman now. Like, I've just been around the block and like,
right.
But it's still. Actually, how long, you're not from Seattle. You moved here, right?
I grew up on like the east side, but I'm Seattle proper now. Yeah.
I'm from Bainbridge initially.
Okay.
We've like orbited Seattle, and now we can say without feeling guilty that we are actually Seattle proper.
100%.
Dope.
And you're still Seattle, right? I was reading this songwriter magazine and it made it seem like the shift was permanent, but I thought you were still here.
No. We were going to be recording at my friend's studio in Bainbridge.
Uh-huh.
And we decided, COVID happened. And due to some outbreaks, the studio manager did not feel comfortable having us any longer.
Makes sense.
Which, again, no fault of their own. Just, you know, that's just how the cookie crumbles. And so I was like, fuck, you know, like the fuck it adjustment where you're right. Just like, let's just go. And so my friend and producer was actually already living in Nashville. So I decided just to fly over there. And there was kind of like a Hail Mary situation. And we recorded for like 12 days. And then I came back. But I'm in Wallingford now.
Still can't believe you did the record in 12 days.
Yeah. It was, we did many 14-hour days.
Man.
Which, you know, it was kind of great to have, how do I put this? Do you know a lot of like the nervous, weird energy around the beginning of when COVID struck, yeah, where there was like, you had a lot of energy, but you didn't know where to direct it?
100%.
It was nice to have like a funnel for that. And so if anything, I think the record allowed me to ease in to what COVID would be by being like, okay, I made a thing and I now I'm able to like sit on it and think about it and have a project to kind of carry me through these weird, uncertain, especially for musicians and performers, times.
Wow. Now I'm more even blown away that it was 12 days. It sounds incredible. And I'm recognizing that it was done 12 days. I'm like, I need to rethink everything that I do.
But here's the thing though, is that like, how do I put this? Like, I had had a band here that I was going to record with. And so then I had like a 2-day period of, oh shit, what am I going to do? And so I ended up transcribing and literally writing out everyone's parts roughly. It was like a harrowed all-nighter experience, like a little Ernest Hemingway kind of situation where like I have like a little snifter of whiskey and like there's like one light on my face.
Yeah.
But I ended up, Nick, again, my good buddy, who's also Nick Bullock, he's the producer of that album, knew some people whose all their tours had gotten canceled because of COVID. And so I was just able to hook me up with some really awesome musicians who I was able to really connect with. So I would say the 12 days is impressive, not because of me, but because I was able to just score really great, genuine, and talented people. So if anything, I just super lucked out.
Yeah. Well, there's just so many layers to it, which I think was incredible. Like towards the end of the album, there was like a lot of like the trumpets and then string work through it. So it was just one of those where I was like, the way I made it up in my mind was like, skeleton and then move on and add, you know, like,
yeah, it's that, but times like 30 the speed,
right? That's super cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it really was that same period then that, like, I guess we talked about a year ago, which was about to go in the studio, like I'm about to do this record, it just jumped coasts. What's it looked like since then?
Yeah, so I recorded the whole album just over a year ago in March of 2020. And again, like the craziest time in our recent history. Since then, it has been super anticlimactic, if I'm honest. It's like a lot, which as someone who's rolled out albums and singles before, you know that feeling where it's like you put all this time and this energy in this thing. And then after the fact, I think is where the grit and the wherewithal comes. Like you have to then be very disciplined about listening to all the mixes, submitting them back, being very particular about the changes, all the like not sexy stuff about being a musician, and then, you know, shopping it around. And so for this album, because I loved it so much, in the following couple months, I had ended up submitting it to an awesome indie PR firm. I'd never worked with a PR firm before, called Greenlight Go, and it's an awesome like woman-owned Midwest PR firm. To help me market this album. And frankly, like I was kind of tired of marketing shit all the time, which is like, again, you know, as a musician, you wear like 30 hats at once, marketing, project management, all these like web hosting, all these other things. So it was great to have a product that I felt strong enough that it was worth putting in that extra like dollar amount to market. So that past year was listening, mixing, remixing, mastering, promoting through a PR firm, getting all those materials ready and done, photo shoots, videos, music videos, and then just slowly doing the single march out.
Yeah. So you mentioned like the podcast that you're doing, which is like an analytics focused company for a video game.
Yeah.
Has that influenced how you went to market? You obviously have a ton of experience rolling albums and singles out, but has that experience, and forgive me, I don't actually know how long you've been with that company, but had that pivoted, I guess, your approach at all?
Yeah. So One of the pitfalls that I first ran into when I started making music was there's this myth of like, if it's good, it'll be discovered.
Yep.
You know, which is not true. Mm-hmm. It is no longer the case. There's no longer like people of influence in an audience in a random bar in Seattle. Yep. That's just not the reality anymore. And so I started looking at the approach of releasing my music a little bit differently. A lot of it has to do with like search engine optimization, SEO, backlogging my own website and making sure I am as like highly findable as possible. I have the good luck of having a very unusual name. There's not a lot of couples in the world. And then the other part of it is like targeted ads and a lot of just me hounding people.
Yeah.
Because you can, I think people are under this idea that everything is algorithmic in how things are, you know, presented and how people find stuff, which is true once you reach a certain echelon of fame or notoriety. But if you are under that, you know, dividing cut, it's just a fuck ton of legwork.
Yeah.
It is a lot of just cold calling, emailing, old school, like, you know, just groundwork of you trying to find people that are interested and have a way to present your music to an audience. And so really you're just trying to be as, you know, good of like an old fashioned, like 50s salesperson as you can be. Because again, like the algorithms and stuff are great, but again, you have to reach like a certain level of notoriety to have those be effective. Or have like, you know, a whole team behind you, or have more, you know, monetary, you know, backing than maybe most people are able to have. And so I think nothing, no matter how good your analytics at the level that I am at, which is, you know, like I'm still bootstrapping it, you still have to do that person-to-person thing. You still have to be like a very genuine, like, hey, this is something I'm proud of. I would love for you. And like, do your research. Don't just copy and paste an email. And like, you have to personalize it. You have to do all this, these like hours of just like putting your heart on the line and like hoping. Yeah. And I don't think there's any shortcut around that unless you're already signed or, you know, whatever. But if you're going that like super indie, you know, quote unquote route where you're just like releasing on CD Baby, like that's, people remember that, and it actually makes you stand out more than I think you realize.
What kind of runway do you give yourself?
I think this is one of the other things that is hard for creatives of all types. Making stuff is really, this is like such a duh statement, but making stuff is really hard. And I don't think people always value the amount of work and like how taxing it is, energy wise, emotionally wise, and like financially, like making these products that people enjoy is. The fact that I'm making something that I want to put out there means that I'm putting all my faculties to the thing that I'm making. And then I have to make this shift of then being like the pusher for that product. And then like putting on like my analytics admin hat and being like, okay, here's the rollout now. And I think that transition is very difficult for a lot of people because it's two different types of work and they're both very taxing. So for me, I put out, you know, I give myself like after I record an album, like a month of nothing just to like recover and like not make brash decisions because I'm tired or because I am overtaxed or whatever it is. So I give myself a month of like nothing, you know, relating to the album. Again, which is not something that everyone can afford to do, but luckily I'm in a space where I'm able to do that. And then after that is when I actually start the launch and like feeling out what I do. It's not until after I have a product that I'm like, okay, how do I then deliver this to people? Because before that, I feel for me, it's kind of useless to try to push something that doesn't exist yet. And I don't know the tone of it. I don't have all these deciding factors of how I am going to roll it out. And so in those next like 4 weeks, I am deciding though, like, what is my release date? And then I work backwards from there. So it's like, okay, if this is what I want my release date to be, these are the singles I want released on these dates. And then, you know, I pitch that as an already finished package to like a PR firm.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Because they like it when there's like, you actually have a plan and you thought it through. If anything, you're taking work away from their plate, and it makes it much more likely that you as a musician is going to be like picked from the selection, because PR firms are strange in that a lot of musicians have to like actually kind of audition for them. Yeah. They have a lot of the power. And so you have to make yourself kind of, it's fucked up, but you have to make yourself as like desirable and easy to work with as possible. And so you do a lot of their work. There's heavy quotation marks around this for the audio for them. And then beyond that, I am, you know, priming people and letting like close musician friends know, or anyone who has any notoriety in the industry know, that like, hey, an album is coming, or like, I'd love to like get your opinion on something, and just kind of lay the groundwork that this thing is going to be here, so that it has the gravitas that you want it to have, and it has the impact that you want it to have. And people, I think there's a saying that people have to see something like 6 or 8 times before they actually like register it.
Yep.
And so you're that little knock at the back door constantly, like, hey, I'm here, I'm releasing something. Oh, here it is. Just constantly. And I think the hardest part for me when I started representing myself was like being chill with that. But once I got over that, it was great. And now I'm just really good at being like really annoying.
Well, that is so important, right? Because it's like you put so much time into creating it. It's like it's got to get that same love on the back end too. Yeah, I mean, I've struggled with that.
Of course.
I love your month break in between, because I definitely am just like exasperated after the recording, mixing, and mastering process. So that's actually brilliant. I might have to steal that.
Highly suggest it.
Yeah, because that rollout, then all of a sudden, like, you know, putting dates back together, but then I'm exhausted and definitely not wanting to pitch as actively as I could if I was refreshed. So,
yeah, I think a lot of people, this is something that I had to learn just over time from people telling it to me constantly and like me needing validation as a very sensitive, creative, attention seeking soul, was that what we do is really fucking hard. It is not something that everyone does. Even though there's like more of a platform for it to be seen now, does not mean that it is something that does not take energy and time and skill. And I think us as musicians sometimes are like the number one perpetrators of undervaluing ourselves.
That's real.
Understanding that you just went through, like, if you're to put it in like business terms, like you just like closed a 3-year deal. I just closed a 3-year album in the making. Like, that's the amount of energy and heart and just being on and present that has to happen to create something like this. And so I think musicians in general need to cut themselves a little bit of slack.
I know that, and this is me speaking from my personal experiences, like I have a very hard time not doing everything myself. So like you talked about reaching out to like even a PR firm, which is like obviously such an integral part of the business, but like finally offloading that is really hard to do, especially like, you know, when you've created a vision or something, like you said, it's 3 years, like, you know what it's supposed to be and what it is. Mm-hmm. And then having to trust, this is a personal problem coming up, but like, it's just like trusting someone else with the vision or taking care
Same.
Of it. Oh my gosh. So.
Well, yeah, it's your baby and you've been there like from day one. And I think the hardest part is realizing that, you know, you also pay people for their time and their efforts, is that like, it sucks, but being a quote unquote, like professional musician for profit means that you are a for profit business and the product just happens to be yourself. Mm-hmm. And so you can expect people to do the work that is necessary. And if they don't, or if you feel like they ever don't, you're allowed to fire them.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, it's like a really hard place to be as like a single person who is creating something beautiful and artistic. But, you know, if you look classically, like art has always had patrons or has always been like a business model. Like, we can't create things without support and without a foundation. And so you are allowed to do whatever needs to happen to make that foundation possible.
Kind of a left field question, but
yeah.
In Nashville, did you feel a difference in the creative process by changing scenery? And the reason that comes up for me is just that, talking about like, I guess, surroundings and not only people, but the changing of surroundings may have influenced your take on just bringing an album to life.
Yeah, I think yes, but not maybe in the way that you would expect. I would say that I am someone who has relied a lot on the musicianship of people that I play with. I am a musician who has classically like found people who are better, quote unquote, than I am at playing music, like who have like, you know, just an incredible skill set. I think, you know, coming into this album, I realize now in hindsight that I was using a lot of that as a crutch for my own creativity and my own agency. And so I think if I had recorded this album with the musicians that I had expected to record with, that I had played with before, I think I would have bent a lot of decision-making to a group decision. Whereas in changing scenery last minute and playing with really a bunch of strangers, it allowed me to have and forced me to have a lot more agency and a lot more artistic drive than I think beforehand I was actually comfortable giving. I think for me, music has always been something that is always, not always, but has sometimes been an apologetic venture. It is something where it's like you present yourself as, hey, I have this thing that I'm like, that I like, and that I want to do, and I'm sorry for bringing it to you, or I'm sorry for playing it to you. And I hope that this isn't too much of an inconvenience to your skills or to an audience. And bringing this to such a different point where I, you know, was forced to take point and was forced to have charge and opinions, really brought me out of my comfort zone once. For one, and then also really made me have ownership over the sound that I don't think I would have been comfortable having beforehand.
Interesting. Okay. I love that. And I'd love to dive into that a little bit more if
you don't mind. Yeah, for sure.
So you talked about at the beginning of, you know, mapping all of that out. And of course, you just highlighted the differences and whatnot. Was that, did you realize that going into it? Or was it kind of, oh, shoot, I'm here now. And now it's, I've got 12 days. And
I wish I was as self-aware that I would have realized it beforehand.
For sure.
But it was definitely like an oh, shit moment where it's like after the fact, I was like, oh, the reason I'm so uncomfortable is because I'm in charge. The reason I'm so uncomfortable is because people are looking at me for answers when usually, you know, I play, not even play the part, but I'm used to fielding questions and I'm used to fielding responses and opinions to the point where it eclipses my own. And so I think the other part that is undeniable in talking about that is the fact that like I'm often the only woman in a lot of spaces. I'm often the youngest too, is the other thing that happens, just in part of, you know, where I am. And I'm also the only queer woman in a lot of these spaces. And so I think that before I was like kind of thrust into this like random assortment of folks that, who again were so nice and so wonderful and so supportive and wanted to bring my voice out.
Totally.
Before that, I think that I had a lot of discomfort and a lot of like self-protection in how I would approach directing people and how I would approach, you know, directing how my music would be made.
Right.
And I would rely on really great musicians like, oh, how do you think this bass line should go? Or, hey, how do you think that the progression of this song should go? I'd come with some bones and then just throw it out them and just say yes. Whereas I think after having this experience of having to make decisions, you know, because I had decided to be there and no one had heard these songs before except for my producer, having to be like, no, that is shitty.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, like actually turning my ears on, mm-hmm. which I don't know how else to put, but like actually listening instead of like accepting blindly. And so I'm both like, again, this is no fault of the musicians that I've played with before.
Totally.
This was my own leadership style that has cost me, you know, my own ground in a way. They are just great and really talented. And then they answered the questions that I asked. But I think it has shaped the way that I approach playing with people. Mm-hmm. And I think having just a stronger hand in the direction of things.
Definitely. Well, and thank you for sharing and highlighting that. And I guess...
For sure.
What's a better way to open up that space then? You know, when we enter a room, per se, to play with folks, like how... And sorry to just like, you know, throw you on the spot here. But like what...
No, I'm ready.
Yeah, what is a better way for like folks to then open that up and, you know, make sure... You know, like someone such as yourself is like truly the creative mind behind it is like truly getting the space to create.
How do you not get steamrolled?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like hoisted by your own petard in a way. I think scale comes into question. Mm-hmm. Are you in the middle of recording an album or are you at like a practice session?
Totally.
And I think that there's some nuance there that is going to go unsaid. Mm-hmm. But overall, I think... it would benefit, and this is like so corporate America of me right now, but in terms of if you guys are making something and going to a show and selling stuff and people are getting paid, thinking of it as more of like a business thing. Mm. You like you're the CEO of your own music.
Yeah.
And you have to have the self-respect to model how you want to be spoken to and have the self-respect to model how you want communication styles to unfold. And so what I have started to do is before people play with me or before, you know, I pitch a product to them or if they, I pitch something and they say, yes, I'm interested. I then say, before you say 100% yes, this is the kind of social contract we're going mm-hmm. into, which is that there will be a period of time where after the initial like talking about the song and like, you know, the sharing of ideas, because that's so integral to the creative process. Like after the sharing of ideas and that collaboration where you bring it to new people and they like put their spin on stuff, then there's like, I think there needs to be a definite shift of, okay, we've had this point and now I'm going to come in as the songwriter. Mm. And as the person that is going to be like the name and the voice behind this and say, this is the stuff that I like, and this is the stuff that I don't. Or as stuff continues to create and you guys continue to build ideas, like let's have horns here, let's have strings there or whatever. You can be like, yes or no, or you can veto people. Mm-hmm. Like, I think especially for, how to put this, like a lot of designated female at birth musicians that I know have a lot of trouble being that voice. We're very used to pleasing people socially, mm-hmm. To de-escalate situations or making ourselves small to just like de-escalate situations and feel very safe in, you know, what can be highly emotional situations. Yeah. And so I think one, it's fucking hard to do. Two, surround yourself with people that aren't musicians that will tell you how good you are.
Yeah.
And how nice you are. Because like you need that ego buffer. And three is do whatever you have to do to just feel like you're making something true to yourself. And that sounds like a very fluffy answer, but it takes a lot of work behind it. And when I say making something true to yourself, just be self-aware when you're having conversations of if you're conceding something or if you're uncomfortable with a situation. And then think about if you feel unsafe saying that or you feel uncomfortable saying that in the scenario, you might need to play with different people.
Yeah. For you, is it fair to say that's just like a gut feeling?
I don't think there's like a yes or no black and white answer to that. I think for me, as someone who has been lucky enough to like go to years of therapy and have like a lot of self-reflection time and a lot of ability to trust and distinguish between unsafe gut reactions and safe gut reactions,
yep.
and like catch myself in bad habits or not bad habits. that is something that I can trust. Mm-hmm. But if it's something that you feel that you can't trust, or you don't think you necessarily have your own best interest at heart, one, if you can afford it, go to therapy. Two, find a confidant that is not in a musician or in your musician circles, who does not have something to, you know, gain or lose or whatever in like the weird social system that is musicians in Seattle or wherever you are.
Hey, thank you for calling that out, because that's super important, the whole gut. I hear what you're saying. Yeah. And then too, that confidant, because it is so hard to acknowledge that there is, I guess political is the wrong word, but there is like a political nature to a scene of sorts.
Seattle's
right?
Really small. Most scenes are really small.
Yeah.
I think especially in Seattle, from, again, this is the scene that I am in, and this is what I've observed personally, mm-hmm. is that we're a scene of musicians for musicians. Mm-hmm. And so to get people to shows, a lot of the times they're fellow musicians in the audience. Mm-hmm. Or to get people to tell their friends, a lot of the time you're telling fellow musicians. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of your backing is going to be musicians. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is particularly difficult in such a tight-knit, close community like Seattle is, and one that is so, I don't know how to say this besides like incestuous, like there's so many people playing with other people. Mm-hmm. Having people outside of the scene is so important. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would be, you know, I'm not like so crazy successful. Like I can make a living playing music, which was my goal. But I don't think I would be as self-confident as I am in my music if I didn't have people outside of the scene cheering me on, mm-hmm. or that I could, you know, talk to this stuff about, because they bring the outside perspective and bring me into perspective about how big a problem or a victory might be. Mm-hmm.
That's huge. As far as scale, it's really important. Like if you want to make a living, like you were saying, to get outside of that, because like you mentioned, the Seattle scene's small, and therefore if that's all you're able to, mm-hmm. As far as the musician scene is all you're able to tap into, that's all it's going to be, is like reaching outside of that, which it's a beautiful thing. And if that's not what somebody wants, I guess that's totally fine too. If like, I just want to play to
a you group. Want some tea? Yeah. Okay. I think a lot of that is perpetuated by the fact that, the venues in Seattle are interesting. One, we're one of the cities in the United States where people can cut their teeth, mm-hmm. as musicians. Yeah. We have a lot of small, medium, and large-sized venues. So there is this idea of like leveling up, mm-hmm. quote unquote. The other thing though is that I think venues are driving musicianship more than they should. They're driving draw, they're driving your creativity and who you play with more, I think, than they should. Because it's like, if you can sell out, you know, the Sunset, then you can sell out the Crocodile, then you can sell out Numos or the Triple Door or whatever it is. There's this hierarchy of stuff that then you're like, how do I make my music reach that instead of how do I just make fucking good music?
Yeah.
And I think that we can take a step back from that and think more about how do we support music outside of like the bind that venues have us in? Because musicians, frankly, don't have a lot of rights. Mm-hmm. We have to petition, we have to ask, we have to bill ourselves to venues and say, you should hire us. And usually then they still ask us for, oftentimes, I'm not going to name names, unfair clauses of what they should gain based off of our audience that we bring. Or, you know, our food and ticket sales or whatever it is, even if they're not like 100% a venue and they're also a restaurant, for example. And so I think one thing musicians can do is value non-venue shows, which is, you know, like fucking throw house shows again. Make that like guerrilla shit happen again.
Yes.
Go to like the weird like Woodinville winery like and play that show, because I promise you the people there are actually going to appreciate you more than like 2/3 of the people at a Numo's
that is,
will appreciate you.
I'm all hyped up on this end. Yes. I and also like some of my favorite shows have been like this weird brewery out in Woodinville, so like that, it just, I was like, it almost feels like, yeah, you're reading my mind as we went there. So I was like, I was like literally thinking of fish brewing in my head, like the weird venues or the weird breweries, like out or wineries in Woodinville. Is like that was what came to mind. It, from a personal journey, I didn't recognize till like my band went on its first tour, which was super small scale, but just like seeing the reception at a brewery in the middle of Central California and frankly what they offered.
Dude,
in return,
touring is the way to make you most thankful. Yeah. It is the biggest ego check of any time, especially the first 2-3 whatever tours that you do, because you'll go to fucking nowhere in the middle of Oregon or the middle of California and there'll be 5 people, but they'll be the 5 people that fucking give a shit.
Yeah.
or they just love music and they want to be there anyway, even if they don't know you. And I think there's a lot of, I have a lot of issues with like virality, Instagram and Facebook and YouTube, et cetera, as a musician. Yeah. I think we start feeling that we have to share stuff or that we have to appeal to a certain breadth of audience when really, like, this is going to sound like way crazy, but I think the age of like big fame is dying.
Yeah.
And I think the way that musicians and like creative people or like actors or whatever are going to continue to find work is going to be appealing to like very pocket niche, highly dedicated audiences.
I totally agree. I think with the diversification of literally every outlet that we can go to, like, yeah, what was it? Even rewind 20 years ago, it was what, 4 big record labels. You go to the record store, there's the CD, that's it. So hence big fame. It's like, which of the top 30 people are you going to be able to actually purchase something from? And now we've got, you know, streaming, tons of streaming platforms, all these streaming services. And to your point, even on the flip side with like actors and actresses and in film, it's like all these streaming services. Now there's, instead of 3 cable networks and, you know, shows for 5 hours of the day, like, it's all there.
Yeah, it's not just USA, TNT, and whatever, the NBC or whatever anymore. Which is, I think people can get, I know I did at first until I like did some mental gymnastics. I got really petrified by the idea that I have to appeal to such a large audience, or that I have to find so many different types of people, or, you know, that there's so many other people now who are also really talented who have a platform. And my biggest relief was when I realized that that doesn't, I don't have to give a shit. Again, the fucking adjustment comes back into play. And no matter what you make, I promise you there is an audience for it. And you need to understand that like the size of your audience does not indicate how impactful or how powerful your stuff is. The fact that anyone else is listening to it is dope as shit.
Big facts.
And again, it's like we can fall into like the weird capitalist mindset where success is measured in how many records sold or how much money you have made. But like, if you can play a song and one person is like, I want to cover that, or there's like a high schooler in the middle of Nebraska, like, yo, has got me through something or whatever. Imagine if you're like pushing paper at a bank. Are you going to make that much difference in someone's life day to day? Like, I don't think you are. And I think that we need to give ourselves some credit for the accomplishments that we have, and that they are so humanitarian focused, and that they do have such an impact on literally the quality of people's lives.
Oh, I love that. That's so true. And yeah, like you mentioned, like that capitalist mindset can get you in the, oh, I haven't sold 10,000 records yet, or got 100,000 streams yet, or however many followers. And then, and I think that plays into, like you mentioned, there's this desire for social capital too, of if I haven't gone viral on these platforms, et cetera, it messes with your head. So the fuck it adjustment, to me, that's when things open up to like success tends to come after that. I feel like after getting over the fuck it hurdle.
Once you're less thirsty for it.
Yeah, like... exactly. And then, yeah, I was in like this horrible job, and the second I knew I was quitting, all of a sudden things started going super well and it gave me the nice boost to out on the way out. But I do, there's just something about the psychology of it.
Yeah, it's undeniable because it's something that repeats itself beyond just music. You know, the second that there's something about, I think that those opportunities are always there. You just have to be ready for them. Mm-hmm. You just have to be looking for them. And my dad always has this saying of like, yeah, you know, a lot of success takes luck, but you have to be ready for when luck happens, which is, I think, more often than people realize.
What was something like about getting on the road that you feel like helped then inform your, or did it inform like your songwriting process and the way that you bring songs to life?
Yeah, I feel like it was something that was even outside of the fact that I was doing music. I think there's something about traveling and being outside of your comfort zone that kind of sands and washes away who you are, because you base who you are off of being around a certain environment. Mm. You define yourself off of who you hang out with,
right,
where you work, where you live, all these outside factors. And so when those things are away, I think touring allowed me a great opportunity to see myself outside of that situation and see myself outside of, you know, the cocoon of comforts or familiarity that I was used to. And I think whenever you're doing something as stressful as touring, which, you know, I think there's a lot of myths that it's really fun and carefree and we're all just drinking every night and there's a driver. No.
Yeah.
You are driving.
Yep.
For 12 hours sometimes, 16 hours, who knows, getting from place to place. And then it's like a weird Groundhog Day situation. And so I think seeing and being, you know, open to who you are in that situation and choosing what you like and don't like about that does a lot for your artistry. Anytime you have an opportunity to be like really fucking honest with yourself and look at yourself and be like, I like this person or I don't like this person and why, is going to give you so much more fodder than like being in a cabin in the woods and white and like writing for 3 months.
Yeah, that's so real. Yeah, I felt like it, in a lot of ways it was freeing to me, like getting in front of strangers. I felt like, sorry, I don't mean to make this about me, but that self audit just resonated very much with.
Well, it's true. It's like, who am I today, or what am I going to try on? It's so rare that we have the opportunity to actually present ourselves in a certain way without the context of everything we have defined ourselves by beforehand. Mm-hmm. For me, when I've been on tour, has been some of the hardest shit, you know, just the interpersonal stuff with bandmates or, you know, being like fucked over by a venue owner or like not jiving with the people on the bill or whatever has been the stuff where I think I have actually had to test my mettle in a way that I have not had to before. Mm. I think it's very easy for me, especially before I had ever toured or really done music beforehand. And again, it's not the same for everybody, but for me specifically, to just kind of like continuously push things under the rug or ignore things or just go with the status quo and just kind of continue floating on down the stream of whatever my reality happened to be that day, instead of actually taking action and agency over what I'm doing. Like, and again, that's not super big, but I think, you know, touring just allowed me to get there sooner than I think I would have gotten if I hadn't toured. Mm.
One of the reasons I asked that is just listening to Alligator. There was moments where I was just like, oh, this would be massive on the road, and just like the storytelling and whatnot.
Yeah, there's a song on there that I actually wrote on the road. There's a couple actually, but Veil of Isis was about, we had played a show in Colorado and then had a show in Seattle the next night.
Oh my goodness.
And so right after the show, we started driving. Yeah. And just kept driving. And there's a lot of this like prairie desert weird world in between Colorado and Seattle. Yeah. And I had started thinking of, there's this allegory that's really classic called the Veil of Isis, which is, Isis is kind of the goddess of nature. And she's often depicted in statues and in art as having a veil over a face, which is to mean that man or humans can never fully understand nature and the gravitas and like what it actually is. We can only just like try to understand our place in it. And so, yeah, that just, man, again, touring, I wouldn't have ever, if I hadn't toured, I wouldn't have written that song.
Right.
Like, there's so many instances where it's like, if I hadn't had this situation or this experience, like this song wouldn't have been born.
I'm curious, like when you're driving then, was it, are you like a notepad, like write the lyrics down first, or were you like full on constructing the song melodically, or what did that look, that moment?
So I'm a big, I love to read. And the other thing is that I love poetry. I'm a big, I think one of my favorite poets right now, her name's Kay Ryan, and she has a book of poetry called Niagara Falls, which I think you and maybe a lot of your listeners would actually really connect with. But I am like kind of a notebook hoarder. I journal constantly. And in, I don't know if it was Stephen King's On Writing or a different interview of Stephen King's, but he talks about just continuing to write and putting it in the filing cabinet and then coming back to it later. I rarely ever write a song in one go or lyrics in one go. I usually write like essays and I write poetry or some kind of prose beforehand. And then later on, like I'll be in the space where I can actually like make music out of it or borrow from something that I've written before or reference myself. I think for me personally, it's very hard to contextualize feelings in the moment in a way that feels true. And so I have to have the space and I have to have a little bit of distance to grab those lyrics or grab that music or be in a space where I'm actually have the time to create something. So yeah, write a ton, discard most of it, but keep it all.
Yeah. My partner's a journalist and she always says there's no good writing. There's just good rewriting or great rewriting.
Yes, it's so true. Like, and you know what? Like at the end of the day, I'm still like a person who has like fucking rhyme dictionary up on their laptop.
Yes.
And I'm like, okay, how do I rhyme and make it seem poignant and make it feel true? It's like, there's no untrue way to write a song unless you're straight up plagiarizing somebody. So I think of my notebooks as like a spark and then I can build off of that. Same with like rhyme dictionary. If I see a word and I'm like, fuck yeah, that's the word I want. How do I get there? That's still, you're still writing. You're still creating. I don't think it's as much of a crutch as people think it is. We're just, there's no better or worse way to make something at the end of the day.
No, I totally agree. One of the, I guess I can take you back to the feeling. When I was listening to Reminders, that made me think a lot of the road. It also gave me like very class. I don't know. I don't know how to describe it other than like a marriage.
No, it's super like roots.
Yes.
It's super rootsy.
Yeah.
Man, Reminders is one of those songs that took me a while to write. And it's like, you almost don't want to say what it's 100% about, because I think it's a song that people can ascribe a lot of things to. It's kind of that sweet spot specificity and also, you know, non-specificity and like vagueness that people can really connect to it. I think it just has, you know, any good writing, and like, I think I'm like a decent writer at this point, is fucking live a life. And then you can take, like, you're really just taking influences and distilling them in a way that is uniquely your own. You're just, you know, taking all these ingredients that everyone has used before and putting them in a blender, and you with your own flair are creating something new.
I love that you pointed out, because I was like, oh, there was kind of a feeling I was going through with it, which is making me like reminisce on just like past relationships and whatnot. But I was like, okay, but I feel like I'm off, and so I'm not gonna ask you like to distill the meaning, but I very much felt like,
yeah, you can, I don't mind. Like, yeah, what did it make you feel? Is that one that you really connected with?
Yeah, I really did, and it took me back, and it made me think, oh gosh, I'm about to start talking in cliches.
No, that's like my whole life.
Okay, perfect. I mean, the cliche that's coming to my mind is like the smile because it happened kind of thing.
Yeah.
This idea of truly giving yourself to someone, like Timby, it was like this reminder of, yes, I gave it all I had, so did you. And that's what it's about. And this whole like reminiscing on that was what I pulled from that track. And then I was like, but I could also be just in left field.
No, that's 100%. I think that's 100% valid. At its core, it's a song about a very deep relationship that is not currently present anymore. I think that's as bare bones as you can get to it. And then it's like a reflection back. In terms of specifics, like one thing I really love blending in my music, especially because, you know, like pronouns are weird or whatever, is that I love to blend platonic and romantic relationships, because for me, they have equal importance.
Yeah.
So you never know if what I'm writing is like actually platonic or romantic mm-hmm. in nature. This one happens to be platonic, but it can be read as very romantic, because I think that's what people initially go to for that level of deepness. And I want it to be read as like a breakup or whatever, but it's actually about a friend of mine that ended up passing.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear
that. And I was trying to contextualize, you know, their fleeting and both important, you know, role in my life, even if, you know, they weren't there every day or whatever. Just, I think whenever someone in your life passes, you realize that they had a very important role, or they had a distinguishable role. Even if they were like near strangers, the fact that you still feel something, I think, is very valid. So this song is a lot of, you know, really talking about those. Can you give me some food?
And I know I'm taking you, I know normally these go like 30, 45, and I've taken you an hour, so I should absolutely let you get to your night. I have a Get Stumped, which is like a rapid fire, where I'm just going to...
Hell yeah. Okay, I'm ready.
And then...
My mind is open.
Fiona Apple or Joanna Newsom?
Joanna Newsom.
Tao and the Get Down, Stay Downs or Melanie?
Ooh, Melanie.
Cello or piano for writing?
Cello.
And then writing or performing?
Writing. Oh, no, I take it back. Performing. 100% performing.
It depends on my mood. If I'm in the middle of an album, I'm like, I just want to be performing. And then when I'm performing, I'm like, wait, I need new stuff. I need to be over here writing.
I know. I like to pretend I'm not like an extrovert that needs a lot of attention, but I 100% yeah. am.
Also, I think that's record for fastest of getting through these.
Hell yeah.
Thank you so much, because this has been so fun. And
oh, good.
I'm so appreciative of your time. Ultimately, like, why do you make music?
I think music has always been the medium through which I have been safely and, I don't know, mostly in control of being able to connect with people. And in a way where I can showcase, you know, the things that I love and the things that I find value in. Also, I've said it a few times, like, I was told from a young age that I was good at it and that I love that attention. Yeah. And it was nice to have something that I felt like I had ownership of and that was mine. And so music has always just been something that has been the way that I connect with people, that I build community with. But it has also been something that I can express myself with. And I can't say that there's anything else in my life where I can do both with.
All of that. What do you hope people get out of your music?
Great question. It's hard because I think a lot of the times, especially with social media, my music is so intertwined with who I am as a person. I think previously they were more separated. And so I think it's currently impossible to unmarry them.
Right.
And asking what I hope people get out of my music, it feels to me like asking, like, what do I want to be as an example for people, or what do I want to portray to people? And for me, those things, you know, might not always come off in my music, but they are intrinsic to who I am, which is I want people to feel okay asking for help. I want people to feel okay with, I talk a lot about, you know, sexual assault and like violence against women and queer individuals and really anybody. There's a lot of, you know, violence that actually happens sexually against like cis men too, that is even more hard to talk about. I want to just be seen as like a very healthy, well-rounded example of like a bisexual woman living in the 21st century, trying to get by. And have that be enough and be okay.
Yeah.
And so if people can listen to my music and be like, you know what, this is dope, or that like they connect to it on a deeper level or whatever, that's great.
I gotta say, it's, you're successfully doing so.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. And thank you so much for your time. I genuinely appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much. Also, it was just nice to talk to like another creative person right now. I feel like we're all in our little bubbles,
yeah,
like commenting on stuff, but it's very rare that we actually get to like chat.
And it felt just like so great to finally meet you and talk to you, because like
I know it's been like literally years.
Yeah.
Literally years.
So yeah, so again, I appreciate you going over time as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'm not doing shit.
Right on. But the album is true. I meant every word. The album is truly incredible.
Thank you so much for listening to it, and again for inviting me on. And you know what? Hell, this won't be the last time we chat with each other. I think we've cemented that today.
Yes.
So I'll see you out there when things open up again, and hopefully even before that, digitally.
Truly can't wait. And yes, I'm not saying that in the Seattle yes of I will bypass you the second we hang up.
So true.
Like, I genuinely would absolutely love that. In any way I can help push the record at whatever scale, happy to help out.
This is perfect. Thank you.
My pleasure. And with that, have a wonderful evening.
You too. Happy Friday Eve.
Friday Eve.
And just hang loose, dude. And I'll check you soon.
Yeah. Cheers.
Bye.
If you couldn't tell from today's interview, I am a huge fan of what Katie has been doing. Huge shout out to her for taking the time to be on the podcast. Be sure to check out her new album, Alligator, and really her entire catalog, available on all major music streaming and download platforms. Also, be sure to check out the Made for Music newsletter via madeformusicpodcast.com or the links available on the Made for Music social profiles. There's a lot of great content coming, and I wouldn't want you to miss it. And as always, if you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. Truly appreciate that extra effort, and I'll see you next time.